This is the My Child Will Thrive podcast, and I'm your host, Tara Hunkin, certified functional nutritional therapy practitioner and mother. I'm here to share with you the latest research, expert advice, parent perspectives, resources, and tools to help you on your path to optimizing the health and development for your child with ADHD, autism, sensory processing disorder, learning disabilities, or other neurodevelopmental disorders. My own experiences with my daughter, combined with as much training as I can get my hands on, research I can dig into, and conferences I can attend, have helped me to develop systems and tools for parents like you who feel overwhelmed trying to help their children. So sit back as I share another great topic to help you on your journey. A quick disclaimer. Please keep in mind that the information provided is for information and educational purposes only. It is not intended to diagnose or treat your child and is not a substitute for working with a qualified practitioner. This episode of the My Child Will Thrive podcast is brought to you by the Autism, ADHD, and Sensory Processing Disorder Summit. You can sign up for free to watch 10 days of expert interviews and masterclasses at www.mychildwillthrive.com/summit. Now on with the show. Hi, everyone. Welcome back to the My Child Will Thrive podcast. I'm Tara Hunkin, and I am thrilled to have once again with us today, Dr. Peter Skyer. For those of you who haven't heard one of my many interviews with Dr. Skyer before, I'm going to give you the rundown on who he is and why it's great to have him here with us again. Dr. Skyer is the owner and clinical director of Skyer Integrative Health Center, Skyer Functional Neurology Center, and co-owner of the Brain Balance Centers of Atlanta. As a child, Dr. Skyer was diagnosed with a learning disability and dyslexia. Frustrated with traditional treatment results, his parents brought him to a chiropractor specializing in neurological therapies. The combination of traditional academic remediation and these neurological approaches have led to his recovery. Although the process was slow and costly, Dr. Skyer went from a struggling student to graduating at the top of his high school class and became an award-winning collegiate scholar. Through his personal struggles and recovery, he discovered that helping people was his calling, so he made it his vocation. While in graduate school, he took a special interest in functional neurology, which led him to study under Dr. Robert Melillo, who many of you will know is the author of this book, Disconnected Kids. I'm just holding it up if you're listening at home, who developed recovery protocols for children suffering from ADHD, dyslexia, learning disorders, Tourette's, and autism spectrum disorders. This collaboration has led Dr. Skyer to establish the first three brain balance centers ever built in 2007 and 2008. And since 2010, Dr. Skyer has been a co-instructor with Dr. Melillo in his childhood and adult neurodevelopmental disorder program. Dr. Skyer has over 18 plus years of clinical experience working with children and adults utilizing neurology applications created by Dr. Melillo. Ever the learner, Dr. Skyer has completed postgraduate studies in areas of traumatic brain injury, concussion rehab, vestibular rehabilitation, neuroimmunology, low-level laser therapy, and functional endocrinology. He's currently enrolled in the three-year clinical mastership program at the Karazian Institute, while simultaneously completing the functional immunology program through Cogens. I don't know if I pronounced that correctly, but Dr. Skyer has a private practice, if you're looking for him, in Noonan, Georgia, where he attends to patients of all ages with complex medical histories. His goal is to provide a personalized, integrative clinical approach that incorporates the latest evidence-based transitional science. So it's a mouthful because I think it's important to understand that Dr. Skyer not only has the education, the experience, the personal experience, and has worked with many, many, many children over a lot of years, including my own family, which is why I love having him here with us to walk us through all the things we need to understand about neural development and really how the brain functions or is supposed to function and why addressing things like brain imbalances is so important. Which, before I say welcome, leads me today. What we're going to talk about today is what is brain lateralization and why it's an important piece of the neural developmental puzzle. So Dr. Skyra and I have been talking for quite a while about all the things we want to talk about here on the podcast. And we decided to bring it again back to some of the basics so that everybody has the fundamentals that we can build on more as we continue to have conversations here. So thank you for joining us again today and welcome.
It's great to be here. That was definitely a mouthful.
Well, when you have a very long career, as you have, and you've done lots of things, that bio just keeps getting longer and longer. And really, it was just, I wanted to refresh people to really understand why I can act you as a trusted resource. Aside from my personal experience working with you, there aren't that many people in the industry that have actually done don't have the body of work that you have in terms of your clinical experiences. So thank you for taking the time to share that knowledge with us here today.
No, I'm happy to do so. I mean, I realized that, I can't believe I'm entering my, 18 plus year clinical practice this year, and you've been blessed by having some of the best minds as instructors, originally, and then now become friends and really close mentors. And so obviously the likes of Dr. Robert Melillo, Datis Karazian, Sam Yannick, Dan Murphy, and people that have really made huge clinical contributions over their careers. Dr. Melillo has been in, practice almost 35 somewhat plus years, Sam Yannick, 30 plus years, Datis is, I think, going on almost 25 years now. And so, you try to emulate the best, and so what I've been able to do over these, I think 18 years is be able to take kind of a little bit of everybody and then kind of bring it all together in what I do in my practice day to day, because I consider myself, someone who's doing the Melillo method protocols, very way he would has always designed them to be done, whether working with a family in office or working with them remotely. And then also incorporating the two major parts of Dr. Karazian's work in the functional endocrinology, neuroimmunology space, but then adding that with Dr. Yannick's advanced work in immunology now. And my hope is that in the next year or two, I'm going to break ground on my own PhD in neuroimmunology and start, trying to publish my own papers and concepts that are, a culmination of a lot of their work, but taking it to, new levels of information. So
today we're going to talk about brain lateralization. So why don't you start by just giving people an understanding of what that is to start with?
Sure. Well, brain lateralization or brain asymmetry is the idea that, we have these two different hemispheres, and we have this left hemisphere and we have this right hemisphere. And for the longest time, most of the research was heavily believed to think that the left brain, it was really the dominant hemisphere. And that was perceived for, decades, if not even maybe hundreds of years, where we thought that because language was more on the left side of the brain, that it was the hemisphere that really made humans humans. But the more recent research that's evolved over the last, say, 20, 30 years is really showing how much the right brain really is truly the driver of humanity and how our mind truly works. And it really comes down to the integration of those two hemispheres. And what happens is that there's actually a very, very serial or very descriptive way that the two hemispheres actually develop from the womb all the way into our early 20s. And we have to go through this very specific developmental course. And if it doesn't happen, what it can lead to is one hemisphere actually outgrowing the other hemisphere. And if it does, then it can lead into, a series of symptomatology that eventually gets diagnosed in the developmental arena as autism or Asperger's or ADHD or learning disability or dyslexia or the other comorbidities that you may see, like Tourette's or tics or OCD or anxiety disorders or even mood disorders. So ultimately, when we're talking about brain lateralization, we want to have the conversation about the importance of the brain as it matures going through this normal stepping relationship that happens between the hemispheres. In early development, the primary hemisphere that develops is the right hemisphere. So from the womb till about 3 years old, the right hemisphere is the dominant hemisphere. So when we look at children that might be showing signs of developmental delays in those first 36 months of life, it could be a very good indication that there's underdevelopment in the right-hand side of their brain. And if that goes on and continues to go on, then as they get older, you're going to probably see more deficits in the realm of cognition or socialization or pragmatic language that could be developmental delayed, or you could have immunological issues or gastrointestinal issues. So really it starts by understanding that, number one, we have to have this sequential aspect of brain lateralization, where in the first 0 to 36 months of life, the right brain turns on. Then towards about maybe two and a half, the left brain starts growing. This is why we begin to see language begin to come upon and develop. And then every several 3 to 4 years, the hemispheres are actually switching back and forth, and one hemisphere actually begins to develop. This has been well established in the literature. I mean, a lot of researchers have established this timeline. Dr. Mullo has written a textbook on the maturation of the frontal lobe that was published about 10 years ago, really showing how the hemispheres switch back and forth. Other people, Lou Cozzolino, Dan Siegel, Ian McGilchrist have written about this. So this is not something that's a controversial topic. This is a well-accepted topic in neuroscience and neuropsychology that, you know, we start out. I mean, there's a book right here called The Development of the Unconscious Mind by Alan Shore. Alan Shore is one of the top neuropsychiatrists of the last 50 some odd years at UCLA. And he's written that whole book is all about the early development of the right hemisphere. And so, I mean, these are concepts that are mainstream. The importance of what we're doing diagnostically is being able to evaluate the development of these hemispheres and trying to determine if the child is actually having delays in this brain maturation.
So when you talk about that and these things have been known within the community, but is it reflected in the type of developmental testing that's being done and typically in your GP or pediatrician's office when someone comes in and is concerned about their child's development? Or is this something that still hasn't made it to the typical well checks?
Well, it's definitely a complicated process. I think that one of the things that we may be seeing more than ever in healthcare in general is the fact that most clinicians don't have the time anymore to really do an overall good evaluation, whether it's a child or an adult. Okay. And so when we get in, let's talk about children for a moment, and we get into, you know, the average pediatrician out there, probably not going to really get into doing all these milestone, checks that we looked at. We talked about in previous, podcasts where, I mean, that's even become such a moving target now. Okay. So you're looking at these milestone relationships and being able to assess the milestones in certain domains. Okay. And these domains being sensory motor development being first, the next domain being the cognitive domain, then social and emotional domains. And then you can maybe take it one step further and look at behavior. Now, in the area of physical therapy, in the area of occupational therapy, speech language pathology, this has actually been very well established. I mean, OTs and PTs and SLPs have been doing this type of evaluation for years. So it really just starts out probably with what's happening in the immediate discussion with the pediatrician. Is the pediatrician going to sit there and listen to the parent and say, hey, I have these concerns. I feel like my child is falling behind these milestone aspects. And then are they listening to them to say, you know what, I really don't get into that type of testing, but let me get you to the appropriate, specialist. Let me get you to an OT that specializes in looking at developmental delays. But then you get into a framework there where you have some OTs that are really good at doing developmental assessments, and then some that really haven't learned about primitive reflexes or done a primitive reflex check since they were in grad school. Okay, so there's a big moving target there. There's a big relationship in what a physical therapist may do on their evaluation aspects. So for us in the functional neurology community, and what Dr. Malillo, myself, and our community has tried to do for the last 20 plus years is really change that standard of care. Okay. People that are getting taught by Dr. Malillo and I in his 150-hour postdoc course is open to any provider. We've had parents even sit the program, and the parents are trying to sit the program because they're trying to change how their clinicians are looking at this in their community. We're in Dallas right now. We've been in Dallas for the last past year plus. We have SLPs sitting in the program. We have OTs in the program. We have physical therapists in the program. We have a medical doctor in the program. So we've had medical doctors from Europe come over and want to learn this. So there is a movement, I think, to try to get back to doing that really good developmental neurological examination. Okay. If we looked at videos, or we went back and looked at textbooks of 20 years ago, 30 years ago, there was a well-defined pediatric neurological exam that could be done at 1 month, a day old, to 3 months old, 6 months, and so on. And most of our cumulative milestone work came out of all that work over 40, 50 years. Now, the CDC decided that they were going to throw a wrench in it and try to change some of those milestones. But at the end of the day, we have 30, 40, 50 years of reliable assessment tools in the occupational therapy arena, the physical therapy arena, the speech language pathology community. Okay. And I really like to clump those groups now into like people that are really truly specializing in functional neuroscience, because they're actually looking at the functionality of the central nervous system. Now, they may each own have their own ways of looking at it, but at the end of the day, I've had enough conversations with enough OTs, PTs, SLPs over my course of my career where they're going to go in and they're going to try to measure the child's development, use these different tools, and determine that, yes, this child is 5 years old, but they're on a brain maturation of a two-year-old in their motor development or their language development or their emotional behavioral. So it really going to come down to that parent really pushing their primary care provider, their pediatrician, or whoever their family doctor, to say, listen, I need a referral, and I need to get a referral to somebody within the community that really specializes in childhood development disorders.
So what do you think the biggest myths are about the concept of brain lateralization in terms of how the two sides of the brain work?
Well, I think the biggest myths of it is basically the myths that everybody gets from social media, that it's that, you know, left brain, right brain, and these are the thing, because a lot of that stuff out there is actually, some of it's wrong. I mean, unless it comes from a really good source like Dr. Malillo and others, even Mill Gilchrist, you know, talks about it in his book, The Master and the Emercy. Okay. He talks about the idea that, you know, in the introduction of the book about, you know, he realized that it was actually an article that he wrote about it years ago. But I think what happened was, where the idea of brain lateralization starts from is from the split brain research that was done in the 1960s with Roger Spiri and his group. Roger Spiri went on to win the Nobel Prize for split brain research. Okay. And so we had a big movement in neurology and neuropsychology at the time. And then unfortunately it came out of vogue about the late 70s, early 80s, when psychology moved more into a pharmaceutical-based model, okay, and a more of a all about the neurotransmitters, okay, brain neurochemistry. But there was still labs and researchers that were still trying to understand the functionality of the hemispheres. And then, you know, once the internet got invented and everything, you began to see all these little pop-up quizzes and everything. And so it became this thing where everybody made it too simple, because it is a very complex aspect. There is a very complexity. I mean, this is McGilchrist's book. And this is the first one he wrote. Okay. The second one that he just wrote, this is only volume one. Okay. Volume two is on my desk. And you're talking about 1800 pages written about brain laterality. Okay. So it's not a very, it's, we try to make it simple in the concept of trying to educate, but in the reality of it, it's a very complex situation. So I think sometimes we've made the mistake of maybe oversimplifying it to the point where the typical, let's say, GP or pediatrician said, oh, that's just hogwash. It's too simple. It doesn't work that way. Well, we simplified it for the idea of getting the concept across, but the reality of what's happening in terms of the neuroscience behind it is very, very rooted in academic science and research papers. So,
yeah, no, it is amazing when you start digging around just how much research there is out there on the concept itself, but yet it isn't talked about except for in those generalities and those images that we see out there is right brain's all about the creative and left brain being about math, you know, and those do sort of run rampant, which, like you said, have some truth to them, but it's not the whole story. How does brain lateralization end up really playing a role in neural developmental challenges that you see in your clinical practice? Can you tell us a bit more about that and what Dr. Millo has coined as functional disconnection syndrome and how that relates to that?
So how it relates is the idea that basically one of these hemispheres developmentally start lagging behind early on. And in the case of autism or in the case of ADHD or, you know, child that may have some autism spectrum types of traits, or let's say early on that they have low muscle tone or they have delays in motor function, whether they had an abnormal crawl or they were late to walk. And then once they came upright, a lot of their movements look disorganized or what we refer to as dysmetric, not smooth. And these are the children that really will probably have more of an underdevelopment in their right side of their brain. And what I mean by that is that literally different parts of the right side, we have lobes of our brain. And for the most part, we've always looked at the lobes of our brain being our primary lobes, being our frontal lobe, our parietal lobe, our temporal lobe, and our occipital lobe. And for a long time in neuroscience, we looked at quote unquote developmental delays or pathology in a very, what we refer to as a lobular way, meaning that, oh, this globe is causing that dysfunction. Okay. And that kind of prevailing thought pattern came from the 1960s split brain research all the way up to maybe their early 80s, maybe mid 80s. And then what happened was we started having the very awesome type of neuro brain imaging, like PET scans and SPECT scans and MRIs and other types of technology. And so then we started looking at this and saying, okay, well, wait a second. These lobes are really not working in isolation of each other. They're actually connected to each other in different ways. And so then we started realizing that there's all these association areas where the lobes will kind of migrate together and then they link up. And the really big breakthrough came in the last, like, say, decade when we started really understanding that the brain is really this series of neural networks. And we have these different networks that are doing different things at different moments, but they require those different lobes. Okay. And not only do they require the different lobes of the cortex, the higher part of the brain, but they really require what we call subcortical structures. And those subcortical structures are the structures that are in the middle. If I was to drill a hole straight through my nose right here, I would hit the subcortical networks of my brain to a certain extent. And they would be like our brain where our thalamus is and our basal ganglia and our limbic circuitry, the circuitry that oversees our emotions. Those are our subcortical networks, which are also built on areas of the brain like the cerebellum and the brainstem. And the brainstem has three different layers to it. Okay. And we've referred to the cerebellum for better part of 30 years now as the little brain. We have a right cerebellum, we have a left cerebellum. And we now know that our cerebellum has on each side has the same surface area as the whole entire cortex of one hemisphere. So that's how important our cerebellum is. So two of the primary inputs to human brain that begins to set up the genomic expression of our genes coding for our connectivity to form at higher levels is input coming in from our muscles and input coming in from our vestibular system. So two of the primary areas that are that are notoriously underdeveloped in kids with a variety of different developmental disorders is input from their muscles, i.e. hypotonia, and aberrancies in their vestibular calibrations. So their children may have problems with balance or motion, okay? You could put them in a chair and you may be able to spin them and they don't get dizzy. Or you put them in a chair or you take them to the park and you put them on a little spin ride or whatever and they get really nauseous. So there's an aberrancy in their vestibular output. Well, these upper parts of the brain, these lobes of the brain, receive input from the lower structures of the brain. And that's actually how they grow. That's how they actually differentiate. So the way the brain actually grows, it grows from a bottom-up relationship. It then grows from a posterior-anterior relationship. And then ultimately, it then creates this integration mechanism that happens between the two hemispheres.
Now, I think that really interesting thing for me was when I first started to learn about these things was some of the, you know, the things that you're told as a parent of a young child in terms of, you know, physical activity being important for them. You just assume that's because that's what we're told about everybody, but you don't realize how important it is for a growing and developing child from a brain function standpoint. Because that input is essential to that development. So what would you say in terms, like, I mean, I think, I mean, possibly why we're seeing such an onslaught of kids, just one of the many reasons that are having challenges of this nature is that the way that they often are, the environment that they're in these days is a lot more sedentary than it was when you and I were growing up, even in terms of what we would do. What do you see in your practice in terms of, and what do you think about that in terms of just from a very simple level, the importance of that activity and input to that brain development?
Well, we can take it one step further. We can even actually talk about the idea that is the physical activity of the parent. Okay. And both mom and dad, you know, when conception happens, if they're not physically more active and let's say they're having a lifestyle that's more that traditional Western diet that's filled with a lot of inflammatory based foods and they have an inflammatory based lifestyle. They could actually just, from a conceptual standpoint, create an inflammatory storm in the early development of the brain that could begin to alter the expression of development. One of the leading risk factors right now, and again, this may seem controversial, but it's actually the truth, that, you know, obesity or increase adipose tissue in both mom and dad are probably the single highest risk factor for having a child with a developmental disorder because you create this inflammatory, pro-inflammatory storm. And I think I would hope that a lot of our listeners have over the last couple of years been paying attention to some of the immunology terms that have been thrown around in the media worldwide. And one of the terms that I hope that everybody is more familiar with is the idea of what we call cytokines, okay? And cytokines are these chemical messengers that the immune system uses to talk, and it's talking to the different cells of the immune system through these cytokines. Now, you have cytokines that are anti-inflammatory and promote positive functionality of the human body, but then you have cytokines that are anti-that are pro-inflammatory. And at some moments, you need a pro-inflammatory response from the immune system. However, you don't want a chronicity of the pro-inflammatory response. And unfortunately, because of the conditions that mom and dad are now, quote unquote, growing up. Because again, I would actually even step back and say, it's probably the generation after us. Okay. I mean, we probably all, I know you and I are in similar in age, and we probably have younger cousins that we could probably remember that were 10 years or younger than us, when really that first true generation of major gamers. Okay. I mean, I remember getting a Nintendo and I was, you know, maybe 10 or 11 years old, or remember getting a TV in my room, but I was such an athlete that I didn't really care about it. Okay. And I didn't really play games. My cousins that were maybe 5 or 7 years younger than me, I remember them as kids. That's all they did was gaming. Okay. So that generation of parents came up, and did we begin to do that? And then, and you start looking at, you know, you start looking at rates of autism, and you start looking at rates of developmental disorders, and there's other perspectives that are there on that, but you start merging that with the uptake of diabetes and obesity in, let's say, men and women that are under the age of 40 now, and even maybe under the age of 35, and they're having offspring. I mean, I just did a presentation on this in Dallas in our neuroimmunology portion of our class, and really talking about this, talking about how all these inflammatory mechanisms that are literally changing the way the brain is coding for these genes to produce connectivity in the brain. Okay. And so that's probably right out of the gate, is that then you look at the idea that how much cesarean births have gone up in this country and worldwide. Okay. So these certain developmental steps that are sequential start in the womb, and they happen over a very, very specific time frame over those 9 months of gestation. And then there are certain things that are supposed to happen as a child is going through the birth canal. And now all of a sudden a child doesn't go through the birth canal and they're born cesarean. You just change the trajectory of the brain already again. Okay. So now if we have a child that's in the womb, that they're turning off or turning down the genes that code for the expression of the right brain in the womb, then they don't go through the birth canal, which also helps start developing some of these specific primitive reflexes that start the development of the brain in the first 3 to 6 months of life. If that goes uninterrupted, now we got this little, you know, perfect storm. Okay. And then that's not even talking about what's the enrichment of the environment that the child's born in, you know, after that. So these are the mechanisms that can change the expression of the genes that code for the wiring of the brain. But we're talking about the expression. So we now know this is an epigenetic phenomenon, okay? That this is not a hardwired gene that might wire for the code of your eyes, color of your eyes, the color of your skin, or the color of your hair. There are certain genes that are less environmentally affected. But the genome that codes for the brain is extremely affected by environmental states in the womb and preconceptionally. So these are factors. You know, looking at the factors, the risk factors of a parent who is having a child 35 and older, okay, the risk factors extraordinarily go up, okay, for that, for especially if the male is 35 and older, okay, we're talking about the oxidative problems that have gone on to the sperm and the egg. You get into a lot of the infertility course. I just did a great infertility training with Dattis Kharazian last year, and he really went into this great depth about how, you know, now looking at infertility, not just looking at mom, and really doing and digging a very thorough investigation into dad, and looking at their ability to not only make the quantity of sperm, but the quality of the sperm. Okay. So these are things that we're finding out now that are really increasing the risk factors of how the brain may express itself in the womb, which then leads to the expression once the child arrives, and why now, probably within, I mean, if they have a low APGAR score early on, you can begin to say, hey, we have a problem with probably brain maturation. But let's say there's a normal APGAR score upon leaving the hospital, but then within first 30 days or 60 days or 90 day, mom or grandma, whomever, starts noticing just less eye contact from the child or less motor tone from the child. Okay. Less, you know, mother ease, where the child is actually mirror imaging the caregivers. If those things are going off and those red flags are going off, we automatically know that there is a lag in development and probably more likely to be a lag in that right-hand side of the brain. And the Israeli researchers have studied this. They've been able to show through non-invasive QEEGs on children as early as 2 months old that they can pick up lateralization problems.
Yeah, no, it is actually amazing how much we're learning about all those things. And as you explain, you can start to connect the dots and how it becomes this perfect storm of environmental factors that lead to and can be explained through all the different steps of the development of the brain that you talked about and the lateralization of it. To wrap up today, let's just circle back to, so functional disconnection syndrome is defined as what?
That really is a functional difference between the two sides of the brain. Okay. That there is literally one side of the brain lagging behind developmentally. Okay. And the reason why it's functional is that we can't see, when we do imaging of the brain, that there's no hard pathology. Okay. Now, that doesn't mean that there are children that suffer brain injuries at birth or maybe have like a stroke or maybe children that have really suppressed development of their hemispheres that we might think of having like a global delay where we see problems in both hemispheres. But the majority of children that we've worked with over the years really have this difference in development where one hemisphere is lagging behind. And as the one hemisphere becomes more dominant, it will further inhibit the other hemisphere that's not growing as fast. And the reason for that is that the majority of fibers that are coming across the corpus callosum from one hemisphere to the other are actually inhibitory pathways. Okay. So if one hemisphere begins to accelerate and develop, now there's also thought in the literature that, and not just Dr. Malillo, but others have talked about this, Simon Cohen, Baron Cohen, Uta Fert, other researchers, Norm Gershwin, have talked about this, is the idea that has our modern world begin probably since the late 70s and the advent of a lot more computerized technology and even the utilization of computer science or the advancement of our science fields, did we begin to start creating greater lateralization of our left side of our brain? And then if mom is left brain dominant, and women by nature tend to be a little bit more left brain dominant, and dad is left brain dominant, that they're going to give off offspring that are more left brain dominant. And if you even take it back one generation further and look at the grandparents, you can begin. And so there's this idea of like actually giving off hemispheric traits. Okay. It looks genetic because you're like, oh, you know, dad may have these like left brain traits, or but they're traits. They're really traits along maybe one family line. Okay. Usually they're very dominantly expressive. Mom's family is left brain dominant. Okay. Mom's dad is an engineer or people like Uta Fert and Simon Baron Cohen and have gone on to call it like the geek syndrome, okay? That there is a left brain dominancy, right? And now we live in a world where what's most of our interface now is with left brain world. And that's what's really fascinating about some of the work of Ian McGilchrist that I'm alluding to over here, is he and Jordan Peterson and others are talking about how maybe some of the conflicts that we're actually having in politics and in political discourse and other things, that is because we've moved so far into our cerebral left hemisphere that we can't be empathetic and we can't use our right brain to actually relate to how somebody else may feel, that we're going to get so concrete and so evident about our facts and our you know, hey, how many things can we say in 120, alphabet or kind of thing. Okay. But we're not taking into account how that's going to make somebody feel. Okay. So their thought is that we're moving further and further away from the function of the right brain, which is really truly the master of the brain. Okay. So that's what, if you start reading all and listening to Ilya Gilchrist, you're going to find out that his point of view is that the right brain is really the hemisphere that makes us humans, and that, but unfortunately we're moving that. So that's an element too. And this is really, really well discussed and elaborated in Dr. Mola's DIRD book that he wrote on autism, probably about 4 or 5 years ago, where he really gets into all the different risk factors at the time. There's a lot more now, and we even expanded upon those risk factors that he spoke about. But really, he gets into the idea that, is it possible that we might be giving off these traits from one generation to the next, over maybe the last 3 generations? And that's what's driving the asymmetry from a trait perspective. And then you have all these different environmental risk factors that are there. And there's a whole multitude of them. Some of them are more, researched than others. Some of them are out there on the fringe saying, hey, this might be, but there's not a silver bullet. There's not one thing that we're going to figure out is the root cause of autism. There's not one gene that's the root cause of autism or ADHD. That's, basically been disproven. Okay. But what we can say, and what I think we can say with a lot of authority, is the idea that epigenetics, the relationship of the environment preconceptionally, maybe a decade before mom and dad even get pregnant, gestationally, and then within the first, let's say, 3-6 months, that could definitely be all these different triggers that ultimately lead to a functional disconnection. Now, what we need to do, and what I'm so passionate about, and why I can go as hard as I go at almost 19 plus years of practice, now 18, 19 years, is the idea that we have to educate everyone on how to identify this functional disconnection as soon as possible. Because the fact that we know it's epigenetic, and the fact that we know it's not a hardwired trait, the sooner we intervene, the sooner we have a chance of, quote unquote, maybe even curing in certain instances the asymmetry, if not being able to dramatically change the functionality of the child. And for someone who has 2 to 3 brain balance centers that have seen anywhere from our initial year in 07, 200 kids, to now in 2017, where we're seeing anywhere from 400 to 500 kids per year developmentally change. And then my own private practice, where I have the chance to really work with more profound children that have more developmental delays than what our brain balance centers work with. But more than anything, one of the greatest joys of my life has been able to work with families like you and others that have been able to stay with me all these years and tell me years later how their child is doing. And being 18 years into this now, I get emotional about this because every week or two, or I get an email or a call, like, we're not here without you. We're not here without Dr. Mola's brain balance methodology or the Mola method. We saw you. The email is always usually, do you remember me? They're like, do you remember our child? Like, and for some odd reason, I remember every one of these kids that I work with. And so I remember what it was like when that child was 3 and then where they were at 5. And now, watching them walk across, I got a wonderful note from a family back in December where their child, who was diagnosed with autism and he had maybe some PANDAS relationships, he got a full ride scholarship to a private college. Amazing. And so you can't tell me that we can't change the kids' brains. We're better at it than we've ever been. And all we have to do now is get society worldwide to understand how to recognize these children earlier. And if we do that, we're going to be so much more successful, and we're only going to continually get better and better. Brain Balance is publishing research all the time. We published, like, I think 3 or 4 papers last year. Our Brain Balance corporate team did, with our research team there. Dr. Mullo is publishing research. We have this collaborative effort that's happening, and now we have all these individual practitioners that have been doing the Mullo method in private practice now worldwide, and I get to work with them and I get to help train them, and to see the results they're getting, it gets I know me and him fired up that we just want to keep telling the message and helping families.
Yeah, well, it is why I like having you back again and again to, you know, continue to educate parents and to learn about why things happen, because we like to understand why things happen, but it also informs how we address them. But just that change is possible, and that as you and I have had this conversation many times, progress is possible with pretty much everybody. What that progress looks like in terms of how much recovery and how much function you can be restored is different for everybody. But any progress when you have a child that's struggling, it can make a big change in terms of the quality of life and the outcomes long term. So there's always something that can be done in most every case. So I want to thank you again for taking the time to be with us today. We are going to be following up. There's going to be a part two of this podcast, so I want to make sure everybody tunes in for that. And then we'll be announcing something else that Dr. Skyer is going to be doing with us very soon, another masterclass. So please stay tuned to listen to that. I will link to all the books that Dr. Skyer referenced here today, just in case you didn't catch the names and titles of them. So if you like to pile up the books on your bookshelf and dig through them yourself too, just like I do. My daughter actually said to me recently, she's like, "Do you actually read all those books? Amazon's constantly delivering something new to me. Or are they just for decoration?" They're for reading. So again, thank you for joining us. I look forward to continuing this conversation and continuing to spread the work that you and others like Dr. Milo and beyond are doing for our kids.
Thank you. Pleasure being here today.
Thanks for joining me today. If you've enjoyed this episode, please support us by subscribing and giving us a review on your podcast platform of choice. This is Tara Hunkin, and I'll catch you on the next episode of the podcast or over at mychildwillthrive.com, where you can find articles and the free My Child Will Thrive toolkit too. Make sure you don't miss out on the opportunity to join Dr. Skyer and I for his latest complimentary masterclass, where he'll be doing a deep dive into unlocking the mystery of brain lateralization. You can sign up to be notified to join us at www.mychildwillthrive.com/masterclass. See you then.